Are you an accredited investor looking for a new opportunity to generate passive income and build the retirement of your dreams? Then elevate your investment game with Viking Capital, where wealth meets wisdom. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting out, Viking Capital can help guide you towards financial freedom through passive real estate investing. With strong and transparent underwriting, Viking identifies low-risk opportunities with the goal of preserving investor capital and maximizing long-term growth potential. And their accessible and responsive investor relations team will help you understand how each investment will impact your unique financial goals. With $800 million in assets acquired, more than $230 million in equity raised, and more than 5,000 units under management, Viking Capital is your path to early retirement. To learn about Viking Capital's latest investment opportunity, which is available for you right now, visit go.vikingcapllc.com/best. That's go.vikingcapllc.com/best to get started today. Did you know that within a decade, women will hold $30 trillion in investable assets? Yet somehow, only 19% of women reported feeling confident in selecting investments that align with their long-term goals. Our friends at InvestHer are out to change that. InvestHerCon is the number one premier conference for women in real estate, and it's happening June 2nd through the 4th in Austin, Texas. InvestHerCon is not just another real estate conference. It's a transformational experience focused on real estate investing, business strategies, and self-care tactics, all designed to help women take control of their financial futures. Gain the knowledge and skills you need to grow your portfolio and build a sustainable business, all while connecting with over 500 women who are playing at the same level. To learn more and to get your tickets, visit InvestHerCon.com today and use the code 100BESTEVER to get $100 off your ticket. That's InvestHer, HERCon.com, promo code 100BESTEVER to get $100 off your ticket. Quick disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities or to make or consider any investment or course of action. For more information, go to bestevershow.com.
Welcome to the Best Ever Show, the world's longest running daily commercial real estate podcast. Our hosts interview commercial real estate experts every day to get you the best advice ever with none of the fluffy stuff.
Hello, Best Ever listeners, and welcome to the Best Real Estate Investing Advice Ever Show. I'm your host for today, Paul Mueller, and with the new year just 4 days away, we're continuing the countdown by looking back at some of the best episodes from the Best Ever Show in 2023. Today, we'll focus on self-storage. The self-storage asset class was red hot during the pandemic. It seemed like anywhere you went in the US, self-storage was booming. But in 2023, the market began to cool a little bit. In August, Cushman & Wakefield reported that self-storage transaction volume in the first half of 2023 had plunged 57% year over year. Even still, the company says that self-storage remains a top performer, with volume remaining above the 12-month levels leading up to the pandemic. And with positive growth and an overall favorable outlook for 2024 and beyond, many investors, both new and seasoned, will continue riding the self-storage wave in the new year. So today, we've pulled the best clips from some of the best episodes from 2023 that featured the best self-storage investing advice ever. In this episode, we'll hear from Connor Gross, Faraz Hamani, Travis Balcom, AJ Osborne, and the Sultan of Storage himself, Baird Kleinsmith. You can find links to each of their episodes in the show notes. We'll start with Connor Gross. Connor is the owner of Atlas Self Storage, where he invests in, you guessed it, self-storage facilities, primarily in Texas. Connor joined our host, Slocum Reed, back in January to discuss his philosophy and approach to self-storage investing, including aggressively screening local property managers and strategies for increasing NOI. In this best ever excerpt, Connor discusses why he chose self-storage over other asset classes and breaks down how he 3x'd the NOI right out of the gate on his very first deal. I'll let Slocum and Connor take it from here.
Given that your experience was deciding to dive into real estate, analyzing several asset classes, what was it that drew you to self-storage over the other asset classes that you considered?
The two biggest reasons that we went with self-storage over anything like multifamily or other residential asset classes was, first, we really did not want to be responsible for where somebody lived, especially starting out. I just know for myself personally, did not want to get the 2 a.m. phone calls about a toilet breaking, did not want to go and have to fly out somewhere in the middle of February when somebody's HVAC goes down. So that for me was just never something that I wanted to go into. And on top of that, I think the standard of how well you can maintain something when somebody does not live or spend a lot of time in that asset drops substantially, which is kind of great for us because we're first-time operators. We wanted to go and figure out exactly what we could do without having to go and go above and beyond every other operator who's been in this space for a long time. And so when it comes to self-storage, if the doors work, you have a light bulb in the unit, you have a little bit of curb appeal, or maybe some striped lines in the parking lot, people are very, very happy. Whereas if you're in multifamily and you don't have a Picasso in the lobby, people are going to be a little upset. They want it to be as nice as humanly possible. And so that was the first criteria. The second thing is we wanted to compete in a market where the competitors were not necessarily as institutional and had just so much more money than we did. And that's not to say that there are not institutional investors in self-storage. There absolutely are. And there's more and more big guys entering that space every single day. But if you actually look at the market of, let's say, multifamily compared to self-storage, in multifamily, about 90% of the property in multifamily is owned by institutional investors, people who want to go and buy multiple properties and build up their portfolio that way. In self-storage, it's 92% of all the self-storage assets out there are owned and operated by mom and pop operators. For the bulk of people, it is the John who retired at 65 and took his savings and bought a self-storage facility, keeps it 100% full year round, and just lives off the cash flow and takes most of the payments in cash. And it's an easy business for him. I would rather compete against that guy every single day of the week then have to go and compete against some of these big funds that are buying up as much multifamily as humanly possible. So when it came time to actually buying them and competing against other operators, that's one of the big criteria that we used to decide to get into self-storage.
Those two criteria, an asset class that is simple to operate and an owner base that is not as professional, meaning you'll likely have better opportunities to buy, but also that you're competing against other not as professional owners. What other things led you to self-storage?
It was really those two things to start off. We definitely met a handful of other people who were able to go and have success in the space that definitely caught our attention. I think the one other thing that I would add that maybe isn't as applicable to some other forms of real estate, like maybe multifamily, is because it's also kind of a small business, there are a lot more levers that you can pull besides just renovating the unit to go and demand higher prices. If you can market the facility better online and lease it up better, that's a huge competitive advantage. If you're able to go and expand and open up more portable units on the actual site itself, that's a competitive advantage. So there are just more levers to pull from a value add standpoint that made self-storage a little bit more interesting.
This may not seem like a direct question, but why not look at warehouse or other triple net, more commercial style asset classes? I would think that operationally speaking, they would be much simpler. And if you were willing to buy smaller properties, like you said, you started with a 68 unit self-storage facility, you probably would have found a lot more mom and pop ownership there as well. Why not something like triple net?
I would love to. Personally, I just didn't understand the playbook on how to even get into that in the first place. I found that there were a handful of books and podcasts that specifically walk you through from A to B, how to go and get started in self-storage and how to go and execute on that strategy. I'll be honest, if you look up warehouse real estate investing or industrial commercial real estate investing, there's no literature on the subject. There's very, very little books that actually walk you through how to go through this process. And the only other thing that I would say comparatively for the two asset classes is all of these larger warehouse types of assets, you are very often dealing with one to two single tenants, or sometimes it's a couple tenants per facility that will go and occupy it. The one nice part about storage is we have 350, 360 units at the facilities. If one person moves out, it does very little to impact our bottom line. Good and bad thing. Like if one person moves in, it does very little to go impact our bottom line. So we have to kind of keep things operationally efficient. When it comes to these warehouses, we have record high inflation right now. So if you lock somebody in on a 4 to 5 year lease, this isn't an actual real concern for me, but you kind of could be missing out on a ton of upside on that. Whereas with self-storage, every single lease is month to month. So you can constantly go and adjust pricing over a 9 month time period.
With regards to returns, the properties that you purchased, first, let me ask, it doesn't sound from your intro like you all raised capital for these deals from other investors. Did you, or do you own these guys outright?
Nope, all of our own capital.
Awesome. So that being the case, what is your targeted cash on cash? And is there a defined hold period, or do you have a targeted sale and IRR?
So we haven't sold any properties yet. We don't necessarily go in with a targeted IRR today. I think that's something because we're probably going to be looking into some kind of future capital raising in the future, just thinking into next year as we want to go in and really expand that portfolio. But I think for us right now, the main criteria is what can we get that cash on cash look like? And thankfully, we've had some pretty awesome numbers, at least awesome to us, for the last four deals we've done. So everything that we target is at least in the 17 to 20% range on a cash basis. And honestly, this is my whole point when it comes to the self-storage space. There's a lot of opportunity to actually go and get numbers like that, if not much, much higher. So for example, the first deal that we did, just to kind of throw out some numbers there, it was a weird story of how we found the deal. Bought it through a wholesaler and they had the contract left for another 6 or 7 days. One of the previous buyers backed out. We found it in a Facebook group. And basically I was in Rhode Island with my partner at the time. And we decided, you know what, let's fly down to Dallas tomorrow and let's go and check out this property. This might be an opportunity to go and actually get our first deal done. So we flew down. The guy wanted $400,000 for it. No time, obviously, to get any financing, but we had the cash in the bank. So we ended up closing on it. And I can get more into the psychology around the first deal and the closing of it if you're interested later on. But we basically closed on this property, $400,000 cash. And
quite how many units?
This is the 68 unit facility. Gotcha. This is our first deal. So quite literally, we went in and looked at the market rent, looked at what was happening. Out of the 68 units, about 15 of them were unusable because either they were owner occupied or they had deferred maintenance and busted up doors, et cetera. You have another 5 to 10 units that the owner's like, this is my buddy. I'm just going to let them rent for me for free. And then the rest of them, if you look at all of the market rents, the rent had not been touched for 15 plus years. So we're looking at this thing, and this kind of goes back to the psychology of closing. We're like, it's our first deal. We don't know. Should we go and do this? And in hindsight, we should have done it on the spot, not even a question. But we ended up finally getting the confidence to close on it. And we basically grew the NOI of that property from doing about $3,500 a month to now where it's doing about $9,500 a month. So it was everything from doubling market rents, making more units available, marketing the facility better, really just doing the hard, annoying work that the previous owner didn't want to do in order to go and fill that facility up at actual appropriate market pricing. And now the nice part is we closed it for 400 cash. This was in September of 2021. It was 3 months ago that we did this, September of 2022. So it's been exactly a year. We got the bank to reappraise it. It appraised for 1.25 million. And we pulled out, I want to say it was a little over 500,000 on actual debt. So we got all of our money back, all of the CapEx back and some, and we still have less than a 50% LTV on the property while having the facility basically run itself.
Those are fabulous numbers.
Back in July, our host Ash Patel sat down with Faraz Hamani, the owner of Pebble Ridge Capital, which at the time had 10 self-storage facilities across 4 different states. In his full episode, which I encourage you to check out, the link is in the show notes, Faraz discussed how he manages storage facilities remotely with 0 on-site staff through technology and automation. In this excerpt, he provides insights into that remote management strategy, along with tips on how to find and talk to the right sellers in a competitive market.
All right, so you evaluated a number of different asset classes and you picked self-storage. What were some of the driving factors behind that decision?
Absolutely. So what we like to say is this: self-storage is a small business masquerading as real estate. Or better put, it's a small business with all the benefits of real estate, the benefits being leverage and depreciation and the ability to 1031. But when you look at what is it required for a self-storage facility to succeed, you've got to be good at customer service 7 days a week. You've got to be good at setting dynamic pricing, updating your street rates every single day. You have customers moving in every day. You have customers moving out every day. How do you acquire those customers? You go on Google. You do paid per click advertising. You do search engine optimization. Every bullet point I've just made is not true and not required in probably 99% of real estate asset classes to some shape or form. But it's the name of the game in self-storage. And we felt it's so operationally intensive. The world is changing. Customers are expecting a different type of customer experience, but storage is still stuck in the 80s. There are still a ton of mom and pop operators out there where their marketing budget is, we'll take out an ad in Yellow Pages. In 2023, that's their marketing plan. We said, I bet we can come in, buy these storage facilities that are being run like it's the 80s, modernize the operational side, pull all those different levers of value creation I'm talking about just by modernizing the operations, not having to gut an apartment and put in stainless steel appliances, not relying on physical value add, but operational value add. And we thought we'd be pretty damn good at that. And so far the thesis has turned out to be true.
What other asset classes were in the running?
A lot. In fact, we put our feet in a lot of them. We bought a retail center. We bought land. We looked at industrial, which was super, super darling asset. And I'm today now involved in industrial, which we can talk about in a bit. So we put our feet into a little bit of everything. But where we felt like we had a real edge, where we felt like we are probably the best in each of these little sub-markets that we're in, was storage. It was the most fun. We saw the best results. So we've gone all in on storage.
Who is the we?
When I say we, Pebble Ridge Capital is founded by me. I'm the sole partner. But we is the team behind me. The first 3 to 6 months, I did everything. I was sweeping units at our storage facility. I was answering the phone when customers called and taking their payments. I was talking to investors. I was raising equity. I was doing everything you could imagine under the sun. And I'm lucky today to now have a team of 9 people behind me helping me and over 60 investors that participated with us. So that's the collective we that I talk about. None of this would be possible without all of us.
All right. So you made a decision to go into self-storage. Let's dive into the first property. What was it?
It was a small 16,000 square foot property out in a town called Bay Cliff, Texas. Bay Cliff is about an hour outside of Houston near the Gulf Coast or the Atlantic Coast. This property, we just saw it on LoopNet.com, which is like the MLS or Zillow for commercial real estate. And there was a few things we liked about it. They had an on-site manager on payroll, which is an expense we felt that we could probably get rid of and eliminate. We felt that we had a thought process or an idea of how we could run a facility without any on-site permanent staff. Even though they had on-site staff, you go read the Google reviews, pretty negative stuff. They don't answer the phone. They don't help me out when I need it. The lady is super rude. I'm calling to rent a unit and nobody is answering the phone. I want to hand you my money, but you won't take it. We felt that there was a lot of just low-hanging fruit to pick up on. And there was a bunch of other things. Their rates were lower than anybody else in the market. They were charging below market rents. We just felt there was a ton of low-hanging fruit. It was an hour drive away from me. So being my first location, I wanted to be able to go out there and get on site whenever I needed to make sure I could learn the process and learn the operations in and out. And we jumped in and did that first deal.
What was the purchase price?
It was $800,000. And that was back in January 2022.
How many units was that?
108 units.
Was it profitable on day one?
It was. And most of the stuff we buy is at least cash flow positive on day one. This one was fairly healthy on day one. But to give you the numbers, when we bought it, it was doing about $6,800 a month in revenue. Within 30 days, we had it up over $8,000 a month in revenue. By the first 3 months.
How did you do that?
Raising rents on existing tenants. The nice thing about storage is you have what we call month-to-month leases. If I sign a lease with my apartment, I'm in a 12-month lease. That means they can't come in the middle of the lease and tell me, hey, Faraz, we're actually changing your rent to this. But upon renewal, of course, all of you rent apartments know, we bump up people after 12 months under lease. Now, storage is month to month, meaning I can come in at any point and give a 30-day notice and say your rent is going up. And I could do that multiple times a year if I wanted to. So the day we bought it, the very next day, every tenant got a letter saying next month, your rent is going up to this. And it was about, on average, a 35% rent increase for all tenants.
How was that received by your tenants?
Obviously not received well all the time, but you have to consider this. And this is why you can't just go do this at any storage facility. You have to do some homework. If I raise rents 35%, but I'm still relatively one of the cheaper options in town, or even if I'm more expensive, but only by $5, put yourself in the tenant's shoes. Okay, it sucks. My rent got up. I'm going to get on the phone. I'm going to yell at these guys. But what are my alternatives? To save $5 a month, am I going to go rent a U-Haul, take a day off work, load up the storage unit, take it to some other storage facility to save $5 a month? Or am I going to just throw that crap away, which you probably didn't want to? You rented a storage unit to begin with, right? We have a lot of pack ratism and consumerism in America that people don't want to let their stuff go. The point being, you do research on the market, you do research on the demographics. And even though, yeah, it's a 35% rent increase, one, what are the tenants' alternatives? And two, this is probably the thing I love most about self-storage. We're throwing these big numbers, 35, 40% rent increase. The average customer is paying only about $60 to $70 per unit. It's not an apartment where they pay $1,500. A 40% rent increase might just be $15 a month to these guys, meaning it's not breaking the bank for anyone. But when you multiply that across hundreds of tenants at a storage facility, it's a big impact to the top line for the operator. And that difference, that arbitrage, we can do minimal damage or minimal impact to the customer and have maximum impact to us without disrupting the business. is one of the most unique things about self-storage. And that's how we were able to get away with it and execute that plan in just about 30 days.
What else did you do to increase revenue, decrease expenses, and implement your automation strategy?
There's three main things we'll do at any facility. We're raising rents, and the market is going to tell us how far and how aggressively we can push. We're adding additional streams of revenue. So we require all tenants to maintain a tenant insurance plan, just like renter's insurance. If something happens to your items, you need a policy to cover it. By the way, if you want to buy that policy, you can buy it from us. We middleman and sell that policy on behalf of another group. We keep 75% of the cut of revenue from it. It's a big revenue stream for us. Then we're looking at expenses. The easiest and lowest hanging fruit expense that we like to look at is payroll expense. If we think we can run a facility without having a full-time 40-hour a week employee there, we're probably saving on the biggest expense that's on the current owner's P&L. And we'll look at a lot of other things. We can talk a little more at length about, okay, if we get rid of that person, how do we replace what that person was doing? We've built the software, we've built the technology, we've built the processes to, we can now just put a contractor there for 3 or 4 hours and put some technology and put a website and put a remote team together that can handle the work, the other 36 hours of work that that person was doing on site.
What does the 3 to 4 hours per week contractor do?
There's some stuff that you cannot automate and digitize away, like sweeping a storage unit, or cutting a lock, or making sure the trash is picked up off the driveway. So that person's job who comes for 3 or 4 hours a week is to handle the physical maintenance aspects of the facility and its operations. So sweeping units, replacing locks, cutting locks on delinquent units, and just keeping the place clean, safe, and attractive to the tenants, handling physical things.
Faraz, what's the software that you use?
We use an out-of-the-box software today called Tenant Inc. It's called Hummingbird, the company that makes this Tenant Inc. A big reason we went with this, and now you're going to see my tech side come out. I promise you I'm a real estate guy first. You asked that question, but the tech guy is going to come out. Hummingbird basically allows you to do whatever you want with your own data. They give you access to your data via what's called an API, meaning if you're a programmer, you can come tap into your database here in Hummingbird and access everything you need via code. And we use that to build our own workflows, things that nobody else is really doing today. We've used that to build a mobile application that we have each one of our contractors download on their phone, just like an iOS app. And when they go to the facility, they open the app, it tells them, here's exactly what you need to do today. Every time there's a move out in our software, it populates that mobile app, says, yep, you have a turnover to do. Anytime we have an auction that needs to get done, it populates that mobile app. Time to cut the lock and take pictures. So my point being, we use an out-of-the-box software that we like a lot, but a lot of the things that we've built on our own, purpose-built for this specific style of managing a storage facility.
Does that software integrate with an automated gate?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. So let me play devil's advocate now. There's a lot of competition in self-storage. Everybody's chasing those mom and pop operators that last mile.
Absolutely.
How are you competing with all the people that are out there?
You're asking how are we competing with other operators?
Other people looking for deals as well. Yes.
Oh, it is a tough landscape right now. We primarily win most of our deals going direct to seller. We're not buying traditionally from brokers, although we love our brokers and we look at all of their deals and underwrite and send offers, but we won 90% of our deals cold calling and going directly to the seller. Beginning of 2022 worked a lot better. We would talk to people. Sure, I'm interested in listening. I'll hear an offer. Plus interest rates were 3.5%, 4%. So we could make compelling offers. Today, if I call somebody, man, you're the fifth call I got this week. So the cat's out of the bag a little bit. It's getting harder and harder and harder to just do the same playbook and win in 2023. It's a very saturated space. I would probably go as far as to say in commercial real estate and a small scale sub-institutional, there are more people calling into storage facilities than probably any other asset class in commercial real estate. That just means we have to get smarter. And we have, and we're doing a lot of things that we think are outside the box and how we can reach owners, how we can identify who is the most likely people to sell, how can we get them before other people, how can we more consistently follow up with them. That's a combination of hiring the right talent, putting software and automation into place behind our acquisitions engine. Even on the acquisition side, I feel like we're doing some things that probably no other people are doing.
Like what?
So the first thing you have to do if you're reaching out to storage facilities is you got to have a list of storage facilities. Who are the facilities that I'm going to call? Traditionally, a lot of people, especially, you know, for example, maybe in wholesaling or maybe in the cold calling call centers, they'll just buy lists. There's companies you can buy lists from. Here's lists of properties. One thing we did is, well, storage is a business, just like a restaurant is a business or a hair salon is a business. Meaning if I go type into Google storage near me, a bunch of storage facilities are going to pop up. If I go type warehouse near me, a bunch of warehouses may not pop up because theirs are not businesses listed on Google Maps. Storage facilities are. So we took it a step further. Well, Google Maps has an API ecosystem, meaning we can programmatically say, give me every storage facility in this radius, and Google spit back at me what their names are, what the addresses are, what the phone numbers are. So now we're curating lists of storage facilities. With the click of a button, boom, I have a list of 100. We have other software we feed it through. By the time it's done, I can tell you at the storage facility, here's the people who own it. Here's who owned it last. Here's how old that person is. Here's how much debt is left on the property. Here's when that debt matures. Here's how many times we've called that person in the past. Here's what they told us last time. Here's last time we texted them. Here's last time we sent them a letter. We have such robust information that I feel like we know who is likely to sell. We know exactly how to get to them. We know how many times we've attempted to get to them. And we make sure we never miss a follow-up. And that consistency is what allows us to find needles in the haystack, even in today's very challenging acquisition environment.
Faraz, is there an ideal seller for self-storage? Is it age-related? Is it debt-related?
Yeah, we say there needs to be an urgency factor. That's the phrase that we use. If somebody's just like, sure, I'm willing to hear an offer to see how much money I can get, I tell our folks and our team, that's not our seller. We're just going to get market price on that asset. They need an urgency factor. A lot of times that is retirement. Hey, I've been running this facility for 30 years. I'm getting old. I'm done with it. I've made my money. My basis in this property might be like $100,000 because I built it in the 80s. And I'll sell it to you today for $2 billion. It'll be life-changing for me and my family. Retirement is a big, big urgency factor. But we've seen others. We've seen a guy where he says, well, I want to buy a trucking business. I got to get $1 million together in the next 2 months. Can you help me do that? I'll sell you my storage facility at this price if you can close in 2 months. Urgency factor. The guy was in his 40s. He's not retiring. In fact, he's going harder and harder. There needs to be an urgency factor for you to win deals at below market prices 100% of the time.
Yeah, that's great to hear. So when you're following up or when you're calling these owners, that's what you're diving into, right? Is there an urgency? Why are you selling? They're not even wanting to sell. Often you're hitting them up before it goes to market. So have you considered selling? If so, why?
Exactly. Look, I tell our team this all the time too. On a cold call, you are a stranger that's got 30 seconds to a minute of the seller's attention. In that 30 seconds, are you going to convince someone to sell their storage facility that doesn't want to? You're a stranger. You have no credibility with them. They don't know you. That's a fool's errand. That's a huge uphill battle. Our job is not to convince people to sell. Our job is to get through as many people as possible to find out who's already got the seed of selling planted in their mind. And then it's our job to water that sometimes. Why are you looking to sell? Retirement. How is it for you? How many hours a week are you putting in? Man, that's tough. What would you do with the money? Our favorite question. If you had the $2 million, so what would you do with it? Are you going to go to the islands? You're going to go buy a cabin? And we want to just water that seed in their mind. We don't want to be the ones to plant it. You can't do that in 30 seconds. But if it's already there, we want to find the people that have already got this inkling of maybe I should sell in their mind. That is who we're targeting.
Yeah, great advice there. People get emotionally attached to the money upon sale. So often when you're close to a closing, you have some leverage in retrading because the money is often already spent in their minds. This is what I'm going to do. I already told my spouse that we're going to move on, buy your dream house, whatever it is. So yeah, playing on those emotions often will yield some leverage towards you. Good.
Back in March, Travis Balcom, president of Balcomi Capital, joined Slocum on the Best Ever Show. In his full episode, Travis discussed how he acquired 1,800 self-storage units in just 18 months. In this excerpt, he takes us through his due diligence process and how he evaluates self-storage investments.
What do you think are the most important components to the due diligence process when you're looking at either buying an existing facility or when you're looking at land that could be developed into storage? Another way to ask that question is, maybe not in your own experience, but where do you see the most mistakes made, or where do you see mistakes being the most costly in due diligence?
That is a great question. People don't need self-storage. They need to live in a house. They don't need to store their stuff. They can put it in the garage. They can throw it away. They can give it to someone else. They can try to sell it at a garage sale. They don't need to store it. But for some reason, Americans hate throwing stuff away. So self-storage industry is really big in America. And so in that thread, basically the storage market, when you're looking at a piece of land or an existing facility, you want to see who are the competitors and how full are those competitors. So if you do a 3 to 5 mile radius search, Extra Space says that they pull most of their tenants through a 4 mile radius of where their facility is. So if their facility is here, They're basically taking tenants from 4 miles away on a radius of that. So you want to pull a 4 mile radius search of all the storage facilities in that area and then all the population in that area as well. So you get your population and then you get your storage facilities. You want to secret shop those. So you call them and say, hey, Slocum, this is Travis. I'm flipping a house down the street. I need 7 10x10s to put my building materials in. Can you help me with that? And if your response is, oh yeah, you have plenty of storage for here, just come on down. We'll figure something out for you. So that'll be one of the responses. Or the second response will be like, oh man, 7? You can tell it's kind of stressing them out. And they're like, all we got right now is a 5x10. And you're like, okay, all right, well, I'll call someone else. Thank you so much. And typically those managers, if they're really well-trained, they'll try to get you that 5x10. They're not sweet little grandmas just hanging out in those rooms. They're really good at helping people. So one thing you learned is if all they have is a 5x10 is that they're completely full. And so there's probably enough demand for more units. And if you call the other 7 facilities or whatever in that area, and those are also full, or maybe you get on their website and you see that they're full because their units available are like, you know, if it says 10 by 10 and it says waiting list, 5 by 10 waiting list, then you know that there's probably some good opportunity. Another way you could do that is hire a third party feasibility lady. And typically a lot of banks require that. That's what we do is we think we find a pretty good property, then we'll hire a third party consultant to go for like $7,500 to go in there and make sure that what we found is the same thing they're finding. The person we use has 35 years of experience with storage. I'm 37, so she has been doing this since I was born, basically. So she knows more than I do about it. She's seen the trends. She's seen what happens, that sort of thing. She knows how to move things around and really pull the data correctly. So that's one of the best things to do. Outside of that, if you're building, you really need a big square of land. We've attempted and we're doing it, but it's a lot more expensive than you otherwise would. But if you can get a big square, you can get your building costs could be a lot less than if you have a long, narrow piece of land. So that'll get you pretty far. That'll get you a lot further than just wondering, scratching your head on if you have a good deal. Another thing is on the subject property, you want to look to make sure it has somewhere around 90% occupancy or more. If it has like 94, 95, you know that you can probably raise rates without losing a lot of tenants. If you lose a little bit of tenants, you're still going to be at that 85% occupancy mark, which is basically, I know in apartments or in multifamily, 90 to 92% is considered stabilized. Well, in storage, 85% is considered stabilized. So if they're above 85%, generally speaking, you can raise rents. If they're below that, we're increasing marketing to get that up to that 90% so that we can raise rents, that sort of thing.
We'll get back to the show with first some sponsors I'm confident you'll find value in learning more about. Deciding how to invest your capital is more challenging than ever. That's why it's never been more important to partner with a company with a solid track record and that has thrived through various economic cycles. Companies like BAM Capital. BAM Capital is a trusted multifamily syndicator that has delivered a historical average of over 35% IRR with an average hold period of 3.5 years. BAM Capital has never missed a preferred payment, never lost an LP's investment, and never called capital past the subscription amount. BAM Capital is currently raising capital for a fund designed for accredited investors targeting a 15 to 20% IRR and a 2 to 2.5x equity multiple to its investors over a 3 to 5 year hold period. If you're an accredited investor and you want to learn more about multifamily investment opportunities with BAM Capital, visit capital.thebamcompanies.com. Again, that's capital.thebamcompanies.com.
AJ Osborne is the CEO and founder of Cedar Creek Capital, which is a vertically integrated real estate private equity firm specializing in the acquisition, development, and management of self-storage facilities. In his episode in July with Slocum, AJ discussed what caused the self-storage asset class to peak and drop in the last few years, and why his firm's buying behavior has changed completely as a result. In this excerpt, he explains his firm's buying strategy in 2023, and how he accounts for the threat of new construction disrupting the supply and demand balance in a particular market.
Outside of all the distress factors, what is it or where is it that you're targeting your acquisitions right now? Call it the end of Q2 2023.
That's a great question. Right now, our targets for our acquisition, we are very sensitive to supply. So first of all, we do not believe the economy is turning around and we're catching it at a bottom. So I don't time markets. I want to make sure that's very, very clear. Hence the reason why I'm a buyer all the time. I don't time markets, but my money usually does. meaning that it's just predicated on yield. So I don't think that markets are going to be better moving into next year. So we're going to go into a market that's going to just get this massive uptick. So that's not how our buying decisions work. We are very interested in long-term growth rates that usually we are priced out of. So I'm very interested in markets that over the last 3 years, I couldn't go to because there was no yield and there was a lot of risk at that time or the last few years. Where now everybody's running away from, we can look and get good assets that are long-term benefiting. So we are mostly concentrated in the Midwest, Southwest, and the Northwest, largely. We are very interested in the Southeast, and we continue to be interested in the regions that we are in. We want to see, generally speaking, very long-term trends. And we're looking at micro supply and demand. And when we have properties that meet those requirements and an operator that doesn't need to be in distress, but just doesn't operate at our level, we snatch them up and we buy them. Now, obviously, that can come in all shapes and sizes. But generally speaking, we're looking at 60 plus thousand net rentable square feet. We want gross potential revenue to be 400,000 plus. And we are looking within regions that we already are in, or we're looking in regions that we may be entering now, like the Phoenix metro area, which we had not been able to enter in over the last few years just because the yield didn't work for us, as well as other markets like that, that we view that this is a great opening and we're having realistic conversations with owners as opposed to just pie in the sky stuff. It doesn't mean they're distressed, but it just means that we have access to better opportunities than we had. As far as it's just not crazy priced.
That's very helpful. I have one more question, AJ, before we transition this episode. I've been a host of this podcast for about a year and a half now, and I interviewed some self-storage investors very early on. I heard more so at the end of 21 and early 22. Those are the interviews that are giving me the compulsion to ask this question, though I've heard a similar sentiment repeated since then. I don't know that I've heard you bring this up specifically, although we've talked about supply and demand, and we've talked about $5 billion a year in new development. When I have asked the question in the past, where to look to buy or where to look to break into the market with a smaller asset, for a listener or me, considering our first self-storage property, almost everyone I've asked has cautioned or at least said, put it in your due diligence to figure out how much more supply can be added to the area soon. Of course, look at what's being developed currently, but also look at the barriers to entry for new self-storage in that area prior to considering purchasing in the area. Is that a major factor for you now in your purchasing decisions?
Well, let me put it like this. I have a saying that goes, you could be the smartest self-storage operator, most powerful in the world, and buy in a market that will be oversupplied and you will fail. You could be the dumbest self-storage operator and investor and buy in a market that is undersupplied and be outrageously successful. So it is the first line that we care about. Everything else is mute if we think there will be new added supply due to either future plans, zoning requirements, all of those things in an area. We generally don't want to risk it. Now, if we know their supply and there maybe even be fill-up troubles, if we can see a run rate on that that we could get out, great. But we're very, very sensitive to that because the number one thing that kills self-storage is self-storage. So it's a very easy asset class to overbuild in. Low barriers of entry, low cost. And compared to other commercial real estate assets, a lot of people can just go jump into it and it's a build it and they will come mentality. So that is a very big concern and something we analyze in depth on.
In your due diligence, how is it that you analyze for future supply potential?
So future supply potential for self-storage is a combination of two things. So we have what I would call the near-term supply. So we can actually go, we work with the city, and we say what applications have been sent in or approved for self-storage to be built. And we will then look through that. We'll see. Then we ask, where are the areas within the city that the city wants, allows, approves self-storage to be built? Now, who owns those parcels of land? What are the future plans with them? So when we're working with the cities, I want to see, first and foremost, what's already permitted and approved. The next is who owns lands and who is submitting and who has plans to do it. And then third is what areas are zoned and what areas does the city want storage to go into and what areas do they not, where they say, this isn't zoned, we will not rezone, or we will not issue permits in this area for storage. So that gives me more of a short-term future, mid-term future, and then more of a long-term future and planning for storage. Now, at the end of the day, I'm not looking at net zero in a city ever to be built. That doesn't make sense. Where that really comes into play is the overall current demand. So if you're in a weak demand environment that you're buying into, it just takes one even small facility to screw the market up. And it takes a big facility and a small market can just obliterate it for years. So it's a measure of how much it can absorb and where those potential new assets are going and what that absorption rate would look like. Generally speaking, though, if I'm buying and they have a big facility coming in a 5-mile radius, I'm going to either not do it or be very weary of doing it. Now, if it already exists, meaning the new supply is there and they're in fill-up mode, I can analyze that. I can figure that out. So I'm okay with that.
Hold on. You're okay with new supply that's in fill-up mode? You're okay with going into that market or you're okay with analyzing it?
I'm okay going into it, meaning that I'm going to buy a storage facility and there's another storage facility that's already opened up, but they're in fill-up mode. I can look at that facility and I can say, all right, I know exactly the units, the exact square footage, and I can see the asset that I'm buying, the new one. I can see, has this one already been affected? Will it be affected? And then I can also look at the current fill up. What rates are they pricing at? How are they marketing? Are they filling up strong or not? We can start to analyze and see the effect of it. So it's there, it's known. What I don't want is that either they're in the middle of building, so it's not on the market. So I have no idea how the market's reacting to it. I don't know what exactly the units are or it's going to be, meaning it's been permitted and approved. And I don't know. I can't see it. I don't know how it'll affect the asset. Then it's just a toss up. But if I'm buying a facility and a new asset is in fill-up mode and that facility hasn't been affected and you're in good fill-up mode on the other one, it's really strong and their rates are good. Well, then it's like, well, okay, the market's absorbed it. It's not having the negative effect, and they're able to absorb it, obviously by the fill-up rates and pricing of the units.
And finally, Baird Kleinsmith. You might know him as the Sultan of Storage on Twitter and other social media platforms. He's a full-time self-storage investor who, as of his best ever appearance back in March, owns 8 self-storage facilities across Colorado and New Mexico. In his full episode, he discusses his pivot from fintech to self-storage investor and his strategies for acquiring and operating self-storage facilities. In this excerpt, he explains why he targets, quote, crappy self-storage facilities, his secrets to quickly scaling to 8 facilities, and the hardest lessons he's learned along the way.
Baird, what qualifies as a crappy storage facility?
I use that term, I guess, humorously on Twitter as I write about my acquisition strategy. But I'm looking for properties that are undermanaged, typically are not investing much in marketing, don't have much of a presence. I've bought properties that didn't have a Google profile or the Google profile was listed with an incorrect address. Typically, the properties that I'm buying don't have websites. They're typically cash and check businesses only. And in most cases, I'm buying properties that are very far under market prices. I look for properties that are well below market and what they're charging for units that are very similar to neighbors just down the road.
Can we dive into your first deal?
Yeah, let's do it.
How long ago was that?
So I closed on that property in February of 21. Actually, the 22nd. It's exactly, I just realized that.
A year ago.
I didn't know it until now. The 22nd of February, 2021. So it was exactly 2 years ago that I bought that first property.
What was the purchase price?
Bought it for $1.1 million.
And how many storage units?
It's got exactly 200 units.
So price per unit is roughly $5,000 per door?
Yeah, I guess that's right. I've never run those numbers. Price per square foot, I think it was about, what is that? Not good at public math, but...
Well, that's okay. So hold on. This is a good exercise. What is the metric that you use? I don't know, right? I'm asking.
Yeah, yeah. So typically storage properties are valued based on a cap rate. But I've often said on Twitter, I don't care about my going in cap rate. I'm focused on what is my cash on cash return going to be when I tap into the potential of the property. And I'm typically targeting a 20% cash on cash return. I do look a bit at price per square foot, and I'm typically trying to buy below replacement cost, which in today's market is probably $60 to $70 a square foot to build storage from the ground up. But I'm usually buying property between $38 and $60 a square foot. But I would pay more than that if it were in a market that supported high prices that allowed me to hit my cash on cash return targets.
I love that you use that metric, because that metric really doesn't lie. You can't fake cash on cash returns, right?
Yep.
So great advice for the best ever listeners. 200 units, how was it mismanaged, or what was the value add play?
This one was my first deal. And when I looked at it, the first thing that stood out to me was that it was running at about a 45% expense ratio. And the internet at that point had taught me that a well-run storage facility should be running at more like a 30% expense ratio. So I thought that the play with that was to cut costs. And I saw a bunch of unnecessary costs. They were employing a full-time manager who actually wasn't even on site. It wasn't even in the office because of COVID. They were paying a lot for her. The prior owner was paying about $600 a month to a bookkeeper. They were paying $250 a month to CenturyLink for the phone and internet bill. So I saw all of these opportunities to cut costs, but I paid Nick Huber for some consulting time and looked at the deal with him. And he said, yeah, it's great that you're going to cut costs, but the real opportunity with this and any storage property is driving revenue. And I looked at the prices that the previous owner was charging, and they weren't terribly below market, but they were definitely somewhat below market. And I've found now that I'm the highest priced in the market by far, yet I'm still at 97% occupancy. And just before I got on this call, I'm planning another rate increase for that property that'll increase revenue by about 15%. So yeah, initially I thought it was a play of cutting costs. Now I know that it's the combination of cutting costs and increasing revenue is really powerful.
You've got the highest rates. Are you the nicest facility?
No, I'm not. There are a couple of facilities just down the road that are physically a little bit nicer, a little bit newer. My property's solid. It's got asphalt driveways, security gates, cameras. It's got everything that customers care about. It's maybe a little bit older than the other properties in the area, but I do far better at marketing. So while I may not be the nicest looking facility, I am number one in Google results, where we aggressively collect reviews and have, you know, like a 4.8 star rating at that property. And we show up at the top.
And that's the magic, right? You're being humble, but you're putting effort into marketing your space. And yep, that's what's driving results.
Absolutely. That's one of the things that I really like about storage, is that the competition is generally pretty weak. You have a lot of older owners that probably don't have debt on their properties. They're happy to make the cash flow that they're making today, and they don't have to invest much in marketing and operations. And there's a real opportunity to add value to the property, increase cash flow, and really gain a lot of value just by running these properties really well. And marketing is one part of that.
Baird, you have 8 properties today. What was your secret to being able to scale?
First is I hustled in direct owner outreach. I sent that initial group of letters, started making phone calls, just really aggressively worked to get in touch with owners of properties, and was lucky enough to find 8 of them over the last couple of years that were ready to sell. But the real scale comes with operations. I realized early on that I did not want to be the guy that was taking phone calls from customers when they were ready to make a payment or they forgot their gate code. So I decided to hire a team. I now have 2 full-time, 1 part-time employees. I call them employees, even though they're remote contractors, and they're in Venezuela and Peru today. And now I'm completely out of the day-to-day operations, or almost completely out of the day-to-day operations. I make decisions on revenue, price increases. I do a bit with marketing. But at this point, I'm almost completely out of the day-to-day operations. And we're at a point now where just with a team of 2.5 folks, we could add another couple of properties. And then from there, easily plug in more folks into the management model as we scale further.
Damn, man, life is good, huh?
It is. I'm watching it snow outside, thinking about all the skiing I'm going to do tomorrow.
Awesome. Baird, what's the hardest lesson you've learned, whether it's about friends, money, deals, sellers? What's just a tough lesson that was hard?
Gosh, I think there's 2 things that come to mind. One is you've got to trust yourself. I've got 8 today. I should probably have 11 or 12. I passed on some deals early when the market was really good for buying because I wasn't yet confident in my strategy of adding value. And it pains me to think about those deals that I missed out on. The second piece is don't make assumptions. My first deal that I bought, I looked at who owned the property, and it was a gentleman in his 40s, so relatively young. And he had only purchased the property in 2018. I almost did not send him a letter because I thought, oh, he's only owned this thing for less than 3 years. He's not going to be ready to sell. He doesn't fit that profile of an ideal 80-year-old seller. I almost did not send him a letter. Thank goodness I did, because he called me right away and he wanted the capital out of it to go buy one closer to where he lived. And then the other example with that is just because properties appear well-run, like they have a nice website, does not necessarily mean that they are. And I decided not to send letters to some owners of properties that I thought looked pretty nice and didn't have the opportunity for value add. And one of those actually came on the market at a price that I would have gladly paid after I looked at the financials. And unfortunately, I was just too slow to it and didn't win that one. So don't make assumptions. Cast the net wide. And then from there, you can filter out what's a good deal versus a bad deal.
That is great advice. Thank you for sharing that. And I'm glad you made that call. Otherwise, you might have been running a plumbing company right now.
Yeah, that's
right. Good for you, man.
That's it for today. Thank you, Best Ever listeners. I hope you enjoyed this roundup of some of our favorite Best Ever clips from 2023. Be sure to tune in tomorrow and through the new year for more of the Best of 2023. And until then, if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star review, share it with someone you think could find some value in it. Also follow, subscribe, and have a Best Ever day.
Hi, Best Ever listeners. Joe Fairless here again. And one last thing before you go, would you like to receive a short weekly email with proven tips from experienced investors, free tools and resources, and a roundup of the week's most relevant news and Best Ever content? Well, if so, join the community of nearly 15,000 commercial real estate passive and active investors who receive the Best Ever newsletter. Just go to bestevercre.com/access. And you'll get the very next one. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, thank you for listening and have a best ever day.